Welcome to the NorCal Real Estate Show, where we're talking all things real estate in Yolo, Sacramento, and Solano counties. I'm Jeremy Higgins, the team lead of the Higgins team at eXp Realty, and I am here with my wonderful partner,
Andrew Lojewski.
Andrew, how you doing, buddy?
Doing fantastic.
And we've got Nate, our producer. What's going on, Nate?
Not a whole lot, guys. Just easing into fall, so to speak.
Haven't seen you in a couple of weeks. It's good to have you back.
Good to have you guys
back. We had a wonderful episode with Kaylee. Kaylee, right?
Kaylee, yep.
Kaylee. We had a wonderful episode with her. She was awesome. I heard that in the background, by the way.
Yeah.
Well, folks, we got a great show for you today. We're going to talk about the seven most common questions that we get from our clients. You know, this real estate has been hot. The topic, or real estate itself, has been hot. It's been super hot since COVID.
Bananas.
We're talking bananas since COVID. So we get a lot of questions about real estate. And is this a good time to buy? When should I sell? All this kind of stuff. So we're going to talk all about that. We're going to talk about how interest rates remain incredibly low, which continues to keep this frenzy going. But before we get into the main topic, Andrew, we got our quick tip of the day. What are we going to do?
Quick tip of the day. So you've heard us talk about earnest money deposits previously. That's as a buyer, that's what the money that you submit with your contract that tells the seller, like, hey, we're committed to sticking to this. And make sure you have that money ready to go in your checking account, ready to write that check. A couple months ago, earlier in the selling season, had a buyer submit an offer. We changed that earnest money deposit period from 3 days down to 1 day to make our offer a little bit stronger.
More competitive.
Right. Got our offer accepted on a Friday evening. And the buyer tells me, hey, I don't have this money.
Oops.
It's all wrapped up in stock and stuff. And I was like, well, shoot, we got to get that initiated ASAP. So he calls Monday to have it initiated. He can't get that money until Wednesday or Thursday. And we're supposed to have it in by Monday. So every single day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we have the sellers calling us. Hey, where's your money at? Where's your deposit?
I would too. Yeah. I mean, so I guess we have to distinguish between earnest money deposit and down payment. So down payment is the large chunk of change that you're going to be putting down towards the house. And that one is not typically due until a couple of days prior to close of escrow. So you can keep that in your stock account, let it do what it's doing. But the earnest money deposit, that's that good faith deposit that you're putting down. And the contract typically says that that has to be deposited with the neutral third party escrow company within three business days. It's the only part of the contract that talks about business days, by the way. So that does have to be liquid. So when you're writing your offer with your real estate agent, hopefully us, we should have that conversation about how much you want to put down and have it ready.
Yeah. I always suggest have the EMD money ready to go. But when it comes to down payment money, let it simmer and marinate in your investment accounts, accrue as much interest as possible, and then pull it out, a week or two ahead of time and make sure it's ready to go then.
Yeah. Although, I mean, if we could go down, we can go down a rabbit hole there, but if you're relying on every penny in that investment account, you may not want to take that risk either, right?
Absolutely not. So,
all right, let's move on to the main topic, which is the seven most common questions that we get from our buyers and sellers in this crazy market. Number one is,
is now a good time to buy?
Is now a good time to buy? Well, you know what? We're going to be a little bit biased about this, right? Like, of course we think it's a good time to buy. I mean, we always think it's a good time to buy. We're real estate agents. We love real estate. We're passionate about it. But in all seriousness, I do think that there are seasons to buy and seasons to maybe not buy. This kind of applies to sellers a little bit too. I think that there is definitely a cycle in the market, right? So, there's the fall and the winter tend to be a little bit slower, and we'll go into this a little bit more. And the spring and summer tends to be a little bit more competitive. But the thing that we're really wanting to talk about here is the interest rates. So with COVID, we're still in it. We're still feeling the effects of it. Obviously, the feds have continued to do things to keep the economy stimulated. And as a result, one of the big things that they're doing to keep it stimulated is to keep those interest rates really, really low. So interest rates, you've probably heard people say it for the last 2 or 3 years, interest rates are at historic lows. Well, guess what, folks? They really are, and they keep getting more historic. That's the crazy thing.
I mean, right now we're sub 3%, right?
Yeah.
You go back to like the 80s or something. This is before my time, but people were paying like over 20% interest or something crazy.
Yeah. I mean, when I bought my first house, it was 7.45. We thought, wow, this is a crazy great deal. And then during the foreclosure crisis, they got down into the 5.5, 5.25 range, which was awesome. And then, they just keep dropping. And we think that we're low, and we hear these little hints that the interest rates are going up, and they may, by the way. We're not saying that, that they're not. In fact, there's probably a good chance that they will go up at some point in the near future. But nonetheless, they are at incredibly low rates. And interest rates going up even 0.25% or 0.5% makes a big difference in your monthly payment. Could be several hundred dollars a month. Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about, is this a good time to buy? I would actually just totally ignore the market itself, because we're talking about a market that could potentially go up or potentially go down $10,000, $20,000. Seasonally, but interest rates, man, that's potentially tens of thousands of dollars over the life of your loan.
Well, we always talk about, purchasing a home, it's a huge investment, but it also gives stability to your future, right? And if you buy a house now and you get that low interest rate locked in, you're going to have the interest rate for the whole 20, 30 years of your mortgage, right? So if you were to not move, which isn't super common over 30 years, but potentially, you're going to be saving a ton of money with a low interest rate now, as opposed to waiting a year or two and paying, potentially 1% or 2% higher.
Yeah. And I think the reality is that we tend to buy homes based on monthly payment. Mm-hmm. We talk a lot about prices, and we talk about, how much we're willing to pay for a house, that kind of stuff. But the reality is that number is based off how much you're comfortable paying each month. And the interest rate has a massive impact on what that monthly payment is. So if the interest rate is low, it could actually allow you to purchase a home that's $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 more. And that's a big deal. So, going back to the question, is now a good time to buy? Heck yeah. I think it's a good time to buy. I think right now is probably like, the stars are completely aligned right now, because we just came off of a market that was the craziest market I've ever experienced in my 16-year career, where we were receiving 15, 20, 25 offers and more on houses. And, we said 4th of July is a big day in real estate, and it turned out to be true. It's hard being right sometimes, by the way. It's hard being right. But 4th of July came, and holy moly, like, the activity just dropped. Now, activity is still strong enough that we haven't really seen prices dropping a whole lot, but we're now seeing, our multiple offer situations are, one, two, three offers, four offers, maybe. Sometimes if it's a crazy cool house price really well, it'll be more, but most of the time it's like two or three. So if you're a buyer, you now have an opportunity to jump into a market and only have to compete with two or three. And in many instances, none. That's a good place to be. The other thing is that we're coming off of this hot season. And so there's still these sellers who are putting their houses on the market. I think as we get deeper into October and November and December, you're going to see the inventory starting to decline, which is very typical. We see that most people don't want to sell their houses during the holidays and the weather's not very good, that kind of stuff. It's a pain in the butt to move in the rain. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like we're in this real nice sweet spot now where you've got these amazing interest rates. Your competition has dropped, so you're not going to have to overpay for homes by 10% anymore. And yet you still have, we have a low inventory, but we have a pretty decent level of inventory as compared to what we've been experiencing over the last several months.
Well, I think we're in a position, it's a little bit more comfortable for us because we have sellers where the market's good enough, we can get their house sold, but we're also in a market where it's not so crazy that we can't get our buyers' offers accepted either. So it's making our job a little bit more comfortable.
Yeah, this is kind of a dream market for a real estate agent. Like, everyone was talking to us over the last several months thinking, oh my gosh, your business is great. You must be loving life. Well, we came in here on the podcast and we come with a positive attitude. We try to come with a positive attitude, but I'll tell you what, man, that was a tough market. And, but when the, when the news and everybody's talking about how hot the market is, like, we don't want to be those folks that are out there saying cry wolf. But now that it's over, we can admit that that was a freaking tough market, man.
We had some tough conversations with clients. A lot of emotions involved, right? Everyone's just tired and worn out from seeing all these homes on a daily basis. And looking back on it, that was not fun.
It was not fun. And, you know, we typically, in a typical year, we probably sell about 50% buyers, 50% sellers. And last year we were about 80% sellers, 20% buyers. And that wasn't because we didn't have buyers. It was just that we didn't have houses to sell to buyers. That was the issue. So it took us a little longer to get buyers into contract than we had seen in previous years. So as we sit here today, we're seeing a lot more of the buyers starting to come back out. We're seeing a more balanced market. And I don't know if you're feeling this because we haven't really talked about it, but it feels like we're getting a lot more of the double moves where people want to sell their house and then buy another house. You kind of noticing that?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, I think politics has been a huge factor in that too. People wanting to leave the state. But also back to interest rates again, people are now realizing that they can afford their dream home, right? And they can move up to this big two-story, 2,000-3,000 square feet, whatever it is. And, you know, it's a great market to sell in, so they can get rid of that first house they bought. And now they can get that dream home. And we're seeing it pretty often.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm feeling. I'm feeling like in the past, I think we talked about it in previous episodes, but a lot of sellers were choosing not to sell because they didn't know where they would be able to go.
They didn't know if they could get a replacement home.
And that was true in many instances. You know, they would have an idea of what they wanted, but like it wasn't ever coming on the market. And when it did, it was 15, 20 offers. So like, what are your chances? And so they didn't want to sell their house in fear that they weren't going to be able to find a replacement home. And now, you know, I feel very confident. Any one of our buyers that wants to purchase a home, we could probably get them in a house within the next week or two. I mean, there's enough houses coming on the market, and it's possible to do so. So we're seeing a lot of people doing that move up, move down situation today.
Yeah, I think there's a macro look and a micro look. Macro, interest rates have been super low for a year and a half now, so the market's been really great. But from a micro look, we're starting to go into the fall season. First day of fall was a couple days ago. And now it's really a great time to buy, right? Things are starting to slow down, like you said. And a lot of these people that couldn't get their offers accepted in the peak of the market in April, May, June, if they're FHA or a little bit less down payment, whatever it might be, now this is a really, really great time for them to jump in.
Yeah. And I would say we'll end this is now a good time to buy with this. And that is that so far, and I, you know, we don't study the market like to a T, but the feeling is that the prices aren't necessarily going down. They're just not going up. Like before, we were seeing the multiple offers and offers were coming in 5, 8, 10% over list. And it seemed like every single, time a house would sell, it would be 5 or 10%. It would sell for 5 or 10% more. So it was going up really, really fast. I think we got close to 30% at one point. And now we're just not seeing the prices go up, but they're not going down. I'm not seeing them go down very much.
I think at one point earlier in the year, we had factored or calculated that the market was going up at approximately 1% per week.
Yeah. It was something crazy like that. So we're not seeing that. And I wouldn't be surprised if we do see a little bit of depreciation over the next few months, because the buyer demand is going to continue to fall off as we get closer to the holidays. And the inventory will also drop. So that kind of helps even it out. But I wouldn't be surprised if we see a little bit of depreciation. But if this market's like many others that I've been in, it's like flipping a switch where, you know, you wake up one day in the third week of January and all of a sudden you've got 10 offers on a house and you're like, what the heck just happened? Which, by the way, you know, we were 3 weeks ago, it was crickets out there. And then all of a sudden, just about a week and a half ago, I think probably the last 5 offers that we've written, we've been in multiple offers. So It's still a pretty competitive market out there. All right, let's move on to the next one, because we're taking too much time on that one. But that was a good one. I kind of like that one.
Well, it's an important one. That's why it was number one on my list. This is the number one question we get asked all the time.
It's the number one question. And the number two question that we're ever asked is, when is the best time to sell? I'm going to go a little out of order here, but It makes sense, right?
Yeah.
So what's the best time to sell is probably the second most commonly asked question that we have. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a flip side of being a buyer, right? You're a seller. You already own a home, or you're inheriting a home, whatever it might be. And the first step to that is really contact your a local agent, right? You go and you contact us, and we're going to tell you that in our area, our market is very cyclical. We see this big spike in starting in probably March, give or take, and that peak kind of goes until June. And then you hit 4th of July, things start plateauing. And then as you hit, you know, fall and winter, things really start to drop off.
Yeah. And I've, with the exception of last year with the COVID rebound, I've been doing this 16 years now. My family's, I'm a third generation realtor. Not that I was totally following what mom and dad were doing when I was a kid, but I've certainly spoke with my grandparents and my parents about it. And it's been consistent, year after year after year. And then if you happen to be in any type of, educational environment, so university town, if your school system is super popular and kind of a draw for your community, I think you'll see that cycle even more dramatic. So we have a couple of universities in this area, obviously in Sacramento, Solano and Yolo counties. And we see it big time. So, about January, you're going to start seeing some buyer activity popping. So you're going to start seeing some more folks coming through open house. By February, you'll start seeing a really steady flow of buyers coming in. As a result of that, you'll probably start seeing homes start to appreciate. By the time you get into the end of March, April, May, you're going to start seeing appreciation happening at a pretty heavy pace or pretty big pace. And then prices will obviously go up on there. And then what did I say before? 4th of July happens, activity stops, but the prices are at their high point for the year. Mm-hmm. And then usually around the end of August or September, you're going to start to see the prices cool down and depreciate a little bit to the end of the year.
So why do you think we have that natural cycle in our area? Is it weather dependent? Is it because of the university schedule? What do you think it is?
You know, I can't say I've ever done any real studies. I just experienced life. Yeah. And this is the way it is. But I mean, if we were to look at it like objectively, I guess, school is a big deal, not just the universities, but, you know, folks tend to want to, if they're going to change locations, they want to change locations during the summertime so they can get their kids all settled in before school starts. It's never fun to try to transfer a child in the middle of the year, break them up from their friends and all that kind of stuff. So I think that plays a big role. Weather certainly plays a role. I mean, we don't have the weather, the extreme weather here that you might have in a desert community like Arizona or you know, some of the winter communities where, you know, it's hard to get around. But it's still not that fun to go out in the wind and the rain and go look at homes, and homes don't look their prettiest, right? You have this beautiful backyard with a beautiful pool and it's got a bunch of leaves in it. Not so cool.
Yeah.
So, I think there's that. And then, you know, holidays that people are spending money on different things.
Yeah. People are preoccupied with buying Christmas gifts and having family over. No one wants to be driving a U-Haul around when it's, you know, Thanksgiving time. But I think weather is huge. You touched on that. When it's 100 degrees out, 110 degrees, no one wants to be out on open house tours, right? Yeah. And the flip side of that is when it's doom and gloom, you know, slipping on leaves and stuff, no one wants to be going to open houses. So,
yeah. I mean, so getting back to the question, when's the best time to sell your house? I think in a perfect world, if your house was, you know, average Joe house, I think, I would probably consider listing it in that May month is usually my favorite month to list it in, just simply because you have a little buffer. Sometimes the market starts a little earlier in the season. Sometimes it starts a little later in the season or it hits its frenzy. So May, you're kind of hitting both sides. If you get too much beyond May, then you risk maybe missing the market. And then all of a sudden, you know, maybe your buyer falls out of escrow on the last day or something like that. And you find yourself going back on the market after that 4th of July period of time. And you really can mess yourself up. So May seems to give you a pretty decent buffer. I would say that there's one caveat to this though. And that is, and we kind of touched on this in a previous episode, but if you have a home that is a little challenged in either condition, maybe the floor plan, the flow is kind of funky. If your location's a little bit off, something like that, then I think it's more important to make sure that you list that home during a frenzy period when you're going to have buyer competition. So if you have one of those homes that's a little bit funky, maybe a little bit harder, more challenging to sell. Right now, you may have missed the best market to sell that in, so you may want to wait until the spring. On the other hand, if you have a house that is fantastic, if it's just one of those houses that's always going to be in demand, I think right now could be
it's going to sell regardless.
Yeah, but I think right now could be a great time to sell. We've seen a few of those even just within the last week or so that are still getting five or six offers on them. They're selling well above list price. Mm-hmm. The buyers are still out there. And we are in a funky time right now, and we just don't know what's going to happen if any, you know, federal regulations come in, if interest rates tick up, and if that scares everybody. So, you know, we have seen in the past, we've seen people miss the boat because they're being a little bit cautious with it. So I would say if you have that house that's a little bit funky, a little bit hard to sell, I think you're just going to have to hold on and hope for the best. But if you have a house that's, that you think is pretty nice, great location, that kind of stuff, you may not want to take the risk and wait.
So I have a quick question, guys. Yep. If someone is sort of thinking about, maybe I want to put my house on the market, but not right now, should they think about maybe doing some photos around the house now, like in the yard, while it still looks good, in case they decide in February, they're like, you know what, now I want to put it on the market, so that you have something a little nicer to put out there to the public?
You know, I think it's a great question, and I see where you're going. I would, for us at least, we go pretty in depth in the listing process and prepping a house for sale. We're going to bring in stagers, and we're going to stage the house, and that does include the exterior as well. And then we're going to bring in professional photographers who specialize in photographing homes. So if you know for certain that you're going to be selling your home within the next, you know, 6 to 12 months, then yeah, I suppose we could go out there and grab your yard, bring the professional photographer out there and capture your yard right now. The interior of the house, I wouldn't necessarily worry about that, because we do want to have an accurate representation of the home. So we don't want to confuse buyers if they see pictures with your furniture in it, and then we go and stage it, and then they show up and there's a different setup. So, I would say exterior, you've got a good point there, and we have done that in the past. We've actually held off on listing houses to wait for the landscaping to come back too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because certain times of the year, it just doesn't look as appealing. And I mean, that has to make a difference of, you know, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 based on what something looks like.
100%. 100%. All right. So that was number two, went out of order. It was actually number five, but that was number two. So we're going to jump back up. What's the first step in starting the home buying process?
Okay. So back to buyers.
Yeah.
Reach out to a lender. You can get,
we've heard that a million times.
Every episode we talk about it, right? Because it's that important. People love to go shopping, they love to go on Zillow. But you don't really know how much you can afford until you talk with a lender. And that is the absolute first step. Credit score, bank account, all that type of stuff is very important.
And when he says afford, you know, again, it goes back to what you're comfortable with as it relates to your monthly payment, right? I mean, most of the time, people can afford more, but they don't want to spend that much.
Right. So when I say I can't afford something, do I have the money to? Yes. But does it fit my budget? No.
Yeah.
I stick to exactly. A strict budget, and that's just how I word it. Right. Yeah. I can't afford it because it doesn't fit my budget.
Yeah. There you go.
But, caveat to that, not caveat, but next follow-up question with that is, how much money do I need? Right. And a lot of first-time home buyers ask, hey, are those first-time home buyer programs still around? Well, not necessarily, right? But we do have some lower down payment loan options for you. A lot of people, first-time home buyer, don't have a ton of money saved up, right? But they make good money. They can do like an FHA. It's only 3.5% of the purchase price. So $400,000 house, you need about $12,000 saved up for that. Obviously 20% is amazing. It gets rid of a lot of fees, less PMI or insurance and stuff like that, mortgage insurance. But you can definitely get a house with 3.5% or maybe even a 3% conventional loan.
Yeah. So that's part of it. And I think that one of the more valuable aspects of reaching out to a lender, and the reason why I want folks to reach out to the lender more than anything is I think there's a way that you go about the lender. And I think we've talked about this before. What I would prefer you to do is to decide ahead of time how much down payment you want. So, you decide what that is. So if you decide that you only want to put $12,500 down, mm-hmm. then you call the lender and you say, I want to do $12,500. If you've decided that you want to do a more conventional type of loan that doesn't have all those extra fees, then you know you're going to need about a 20% down payment. So decide ahead of time what you want that 20% to look like. Do you want that to be $100,000? Do you want it to be $200,000? Do you want it to be, you know, what do you want it to be? So then you go to the lender and you tell them, this is how much money I want to put down. I want to use $150,000 of my savings to put towards my down payment. And I don't want my monthly payment to exceed X number of dollars. And so you go to the lender with those two figures, and then the lender will back that out, and the lender will determine what the purchase price can be. So the lender can say, if you can purchase a $600,000 house, if you put $100,000 down or $150,000 down and you want this monthly payment, you can afford to purchase a $600,000 house. That's the important part, because again, we purchase houses through our payments, not necessarily through the cost of the house. So it's important to do that ahead of time, because we don't want you going out and looking at homes that are in the 700,000 range and then find out that your comfort zone is at the 600,000 range, because chances are you could actually stretch and make the 700,000 work. But I'm just going to tell you, it's not going to be a lot of fun. If you're stretching to make that payment every single month, it's going to stress you out. There's no point in being there. Every single one of the buyers that we've represented fall in love with the home that they buy. And when I say every single, I'm not lying. Like, they don't buy it if they don't love it. And so we've sold homes in the 200,000 range, and we've sold homes in the 1.5 plus million dollar range. Like, people love their home. So they tend to adapt and fall in love with what they get. So don't fall in love with that $700,000 house if you're comfortable in the $600,000 range. I'd rather you just go look at $600,000 houses, fall in love with a $600,000 house.
Yeah, get those expectations at the beginning. Don't wait until halfway through, after you've been looking at million-dollar homes, to realize that, you know, what you're comfortable with is significantly less than that.
And vice versa. I've had folks that we're sitting on the sidelines a little longer than they probably should have or had to, because they were looking at a price point that was far too low for them. And they were like, well, I don't want to be in that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And so I want to wait until I can afford to be in this other neighborhood. Well, it turns out that they could have afforded to be in that other neighborhood without them realizing it. They had enough down payment and their monthly payment with these interest rates, you'd be kind of surprised. So they could have moved sooner.
So that goes back to our tip of the day from, you know, every week for however long, is reach out to us early and often. You know, give us your questions. We'll lay out a roadmap for you. We'll give you a lender recommendation, and we'll put together a roadmap that, you know, gives you timelines and budget and numbers that are, you know, you want to hit, and we'll get this thing going for you.
For sure. Moving on to the next one, still buyer related. Should I order a home inspection? Are they really worth it? I mean, these things cost anywhere from $450 to $650, sometimes a little bit more if you're into the 4,500 square foot range. But like, really, I mean, should they order a home inspection? Are they really worth it?
Absolutely. How many times have we talked about this?
Core five, baby.
Core five. Absolutely worth it. One, you need to know what you're buying, right? And the biggest fear is the fear of the unknown. Okay. You don't want to find out that you have a bad roof after you purchase the house. That's a big ticket item. That's a lot of money. And we've seen it before. People buy a house and they just have a slew of issues afterwards. Foundation problems, plumbing problems. And, that can break the bank. That can put you in a financial position that's just, you know.
Yeah. We bring this up. I mean, we do get these questions from folks. And I think the reason we're getting questions from folks about this is because we were seeing, and maybe even still seeing, a lot of people writing offers without contingencies. And when we were in the foreclosure era and we were selling a lot of foreclosures, the banks oftentimes would refuse to do any repairs. And so people knew in advance that they weren't going to get any repairs done. And so we started seeing offers from folks where they were choosing not to do any inspections, and we would ask why, and they would say, well, they're not going to do any repairs, so what's the point in wasting the money on the inspection? And Man, oh man, oh man. I mean, because it's not the stuff that you can see that we're worried about. It's not that, you know, you walk in and you see a cracked kitchen tile, or, you know, you see a leak under the sink that you're worried about, or an old air conditioning system that you know is going to break down soon. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the house that I walked into with a buyer last week, and the house looked really amazing. And then right before we wrote the offer, the seller, thank goodness, the seller's agent provided us with an engineering report. And it turns out that they had like 3/4 of an inch of settling in this condominium, and the foundation was failing. And it was, you know, they didn't have a cost estimate, but we've done foundations before. They could be as much as $160,000 to $200,000 to replace or to repair a foundation. Now, in that instance, you know, fortunately the seller had received that, but had the seller not provided that disclosure to us, we would have had no way of knowing that, because some cosmetic repairs had been done in the house. So the sheetrock was in perfect condition. So we would have never known that. We have a listing right now. Get up into the attic and you find out that some of the rafters are literally busted. Like the structural, it's not a structurally sound house right now. You get underneath that house and you're going to find that a lot of the plumbing pipes have actually bursted. Those are things that you can't see when you're walking around with your real estate agent. So an inspector is going to find those things.
Yeah, I think it's here in California, it's very, very common to get inspections done, right? But I've heard maybe in the like Midwest or something, or in the South, like it's not as common for people to get inspections done, right? They walk around, they love the house, got some great color on the walls, we'll buy it. Mm-hmm. But in this
I think what we've seen here is that there's a difference. It's two separate things when you're talking about contingencies versus repair requests. So you may find yourself in a situation where the seller's not going to agree to do any repairs. And that, I mean, that's just the reality of our market and in the competitiveness of the market, but that's separate from doing your inspections. We've never seen a purchase agreement that does not allow a buyer to do inspections. We've seen purchase agreements where they're not allowed to request repairs, mm-hmm. but we've never seen a purchase agreement where a buyer is not allowed to do inspections. So you could certainly purchase a house, put in your offer that you're not going to request any repairs. But then if you do find out that there is a significant $40,000-$50,000 repair, you will always have the ability to cancel that agreement.
Yep.
And in this, we're not seeing it right this moment. I mean, in this crazy market, we were seeing people release their earnest money deposits from the get-go. So they literally, like if they canceled the agreement for any reason, they would have lost their earnest money deposit on a $1 million house. It was $30,000. Well, if you came in and you found out that there's $250,000 worth of foundation repairs, would you rather lose the 250 or the 30? You know, like it still sucks. But nonetheless, they're two separate things. All right. So is it, that kind of going off of that, is it the next question that we hear is it possible to back out of a purchase? Now, I think most people know that it's possible to back out of a purchase, but I think the real question that they're asking us is like, when can I back out and how does that look and how does that happen?
Yeah. So you have in any given transaction, you're going to have three main contingencies, right? Those are conditions of the contract. You're going to have your inspection period. As a buyer, you come in, you get your inspections done. If you're okay with the condition of the house, you'll sign off on it. You move forward. If something were to come up, foundation issue of $250,000, it's too much to handle. You can't stomach it. You can't afford it. You don't want to afford it. Then you have an out right there. You can exit the contract. You don't lose your deposit and you're fine. The next step would be the appraisal contingency. When you're buying a house, the lender needs to send out an appraiser to make sure the house is worth what you're paying. And if the appraisal doesn't meet the purchase price on the contract and you don't want to pay to make up the difference and the seller doesn't want to come down and negotiate with you, then you have an option to exit the contract with no penalty. And then the final contingency is your loan contingency. If your loan doesn't get approved, we're not going to hold your feet to the fire and make you buy the house. You have a way to exit the contract without penalty. But if you were to remove all those contingencies and then you decide to cancel, you can still cancel, but you're going to lose your 3% deposit.
Yeah. With one exception, and that is if a new disclosure is presented to you after that fact. So if the seller if a pipe burst in the house after you did all your inspections and after you removed your contingencies and then a pipe burst in the house, the seller would be required to disclose that to you. And then at that point you would have an additional 3 to 5 days to cancel the agreement if you want. I think the easiest way to put this to make the most sense for you is that there are phases in this contract that he just went over with these inspection or these contingencies. And none of those contingencies, you will not remove any of those contingencies until you are 100% satisfied and comfortable with that particular part of the process. So as it relates to inspections, for instance, generally you're going to have anywhere from 10 to 17 days to remove that contingency. You're never going to remove that contingency until you've completed every inspection that you want to complete and you've received every bit of information that you want to receive. And then and only then will you make a decision of whether or not you want to move forward. So you're only going to remove the contingency after you've already satisfied yourself that you're cool with it, you're comfortable with it. Appraisal contingency, you're never going to remove that contingency until you actually have a written appraisal in hand that says, yes, your house is worth what you're buying, or you've negotiated otherwise. And then with your loan, you're never going to remove the loan contingency until you get that full approval from your lender that says your loan is 100% approved. So your risk is very, very little here, because you're never going to be forced to move forward until you're comfortable with something. I would say the minor risk that you may have is that you're going to remove your loan contingency, usually somewhere around the day 21. Mm-hmm. And if something like a job loss were to happen or something catastrophic were to happen between day 21 and the close of escrow, that could potentially put you at risk. But that's a very small risk. It's 9 days, and it's pretty, you know, I can't say that I've ever actually had it happen. So, and that's a lot of homes that we've sold. All right. So another question that we're asked, how much is my home worth? I love that question. Actually, that's my favorite question. So if you ever need to ask somebody that question, call me. My number is 530-574-3329 and ask me how much your home is worth, because I love that question.
Holy moly.
Yeah.
Gets Jeremy amped up.
Yes, I'm a little passionate about it.
We're gonna take that clip right there and we're going to post this on Instagram, Facebook, him ranting about call me.
So tell us, Andrew, how much is my house worth? How do I know?
$1 million.
How do I know?
Well, there's some factors, right, that are involved in valuing a property. Most importantly is going to be the location. Location, city, state, area is the most important aspect in pricing a property. Second thing would be size of the property. 1,000 square feet, you're living in a box, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 square foot mansion. And then the third aspect, I think, you can correct me on this, I would say condition of the property. Those three things together are what makes the value of your property. So if you live in a more upscale neighborhood, 1,000 square foot house could be $1 million. You live in San Francisco or something, right? You live in a lesser neighborhood. I don't know how you want to word that. 1,000 square foot house could be, you know, $200,000. And then obviously if it's in good condition, poor condition, you know, all that type of stuff.
So we certainly can break it down. I think pricing is both an art and a science. And I think traditionally it's been, there's been a lot of art used, and with some of the technology that we have available to us now, it's been a little easier, to use science. But science is not perfect either. You know, when you think about a Zillow estimate or a Redfin, Realtor.com, some of those, we consistently compare those and we look at those every time we value a home. And it's not uncommon to see their estimates at $100,000 difference. And they're using all science, right? They're all numbers, because none of those sites are able to see into the home and compare that stuff. It's all algorithms that are in mathematical equations that they're doing. So science is not perfect. And art does need to be used, but in traditionally with real estate agents, what real estate agents have done is they try to grab a couple of houses, two or three houses, preferably, that are similar in size, condition, and location as yours. And if that home were to sell for for $400,000 or $600,000, then it makes sense that your house would sell somewhere around that same price. And I would say that that buyer demand also plays a role, right? So because we have homes that, you know, might have sold for $750,000 3 months ago, they might only sell for $740,000 today. So buyer demand does play a role. But nonetheless, taking those three properties and making a comparison, it's using more art because maybe one of them has no backyard. We went on a listing appointment yesterday. The backyard was there, but it was completely unfinished, all dirt, versus a backyard that has plush landscaping and a swimming pool and covered patio. They're the same size house, same size lot, same street. Clearly there's going to be a difference in pricing, and that's where the art needs to come in. And that's where Zillow and realtor.com and these other automated values have trouble. They have a hard time telling that, oh, wait, this has like a backyard.
They just can't evaluate that portion. Yeah,
like a backyard that's worth 50 grand, right? And there's many different things throughout your home. Kitchen, you know, do you have tile kitchen counters or quartz? You know, do you have tile floor, you know, whatever, you have holes in your wall. So there's lots of different factors, but what we've really been challenged with over the last probably 8 years is this lack of inventory. So we don't have a lot of data points to go off of, right? We're having to use a lot of art because we don't have a lot of data points. We may only have two houses that are similar in size, similar condition, and now we have to make all these comparisons. So another way that we've been using lately is we use like an Excel type of program, and we pull all of the homes in a particular neighborhood, regardless of size, regardless of price, and then we plot it out onto a graph. And I think it makes it easier from a visual standpoint as well. And then there's a mathematical equation that takes place and kind of determines what the median value of a home is based on its square footage. And then you have homes that sell above a median value and homes that sell below the median value. The ones that are below obviously are going to be in inferior condition, inferior location. Those that are above the median value are going to be superior condition and location. But what's helpful is that maybe we have a house that's 1,000 square feet smaller, not something that, you know, typically we would use as a comparison, but maybe the condition of the home is identical to what yours is. We can follow that median value line up, and wherever, you know, if it's above the red line by a half an inch or whatever, then that's what we can use, and we can help determine values there. So it's a little difficult when we're not showing you from a visual standpoint, but nonetheless, I guess the point is that it's an art and a science, and the more data that you have available to you, the better. And the Zillows and those automated estimates they're fun. They're great ideas, but, they can be off by a lot. So don't rely on them. All right. Last question. Do I need an agent to sell my house?
Absolutely.
Tell me why.
So can't remember the exact numbers off the top of my head here, but, agents sell for approximately, I think it's like 13% higher than your average for sale by owner situation. And I've been involved in a couple of for sale by owner situations. And, you know, if you're trying to do something that you don't specialize in, you've never done before, it's a complete mess. Don't know what the paperwork that needs to be done. There's no negotiation. They think the house is worth way more than it is. They don't understand appraised value. You know, you can ask $1 million for a home, but if it only appraises at 500, well, a buyer can only get a loan for 500, right? Then you're really stuck. So when it comes to negotiations and knowing what to look for in terms of condition and stuff like that, it 100% pays to have an agent.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of psychology that goes into it as well. I think folks, understand that real estate agents are there to protect them, and buyers, certainly want to make sure that they have appropriate representation. And sometimes I use an example of like, if you went into, I've never owned a Rolex. Have you ever owned a Rolex?
No, not my
style. Have you ever owned a Rolex?
I've not.
No, none of us.
I owned a Swatch at one point.
Oh my gosh. I remember those. Those were so rad. So anyway, a Rolex, if you went into a Rolex store and you bought a Rolex, you know, in one of the stores, you would be paying, let's just say you pay $15,000 for a Rolex, right? If you went into a pawn shop and there was a Rolex in the pawn shop, how much do you think you would be paying for that Rolex?
I don't know. Half price?
Probably at least half, right? Like maybe if you're lucky, that pawn shop's going to get $7,500. Why is it that we would only be willing to pay $7,500 in a pawn shop versus the store.
We don't know if it's authentic or
even
not, right?
Even if it was a refurbished in the store, we would be paying way, way more. Why? Because we just don't trust. Mm-hmm. We don't trust the pawn shop the same way we would a retail store, right? So, and so we want to protect ourselves in that regard. I think for sale by owners the same way. A buyer and their agent, by the way, because an agent representing a buyer and a for sale by owner is put in a very difficult situation, and it can be pretty risky for the real estate agent, right? Because the real estate agent has a duty to protect that buyer. And if the real estate agent's not getting all the information that they normally do, then it doesn't allow them to give the type of information that they generally want to give to their buyer. And real estate agents, because they're not representing the seller, are not, you know, the conversation with the seller has to be limited. So it's just a very difficult situation. But nonetheless, I think that's the biggest thing. And then buyers that tend to go after for sale by owners, you can ask them, but they know that you're not paying a commission. And so they're like, well, I want to participate in that. Like, mm-hmm. I want your commission, right? The commission that you're not spending, I want that. And so it just doesn't work out. But, you know, these things are, money plays a big role when you're selling a house. There's no doubt about it. Everybody wants to net the highest amount of money. Everybody does. I do too. Actually, not everybody does, but. What are you going to say, Nate?
So I have a quick question. Yeah. Every now and then you see these signs on a post that say, we'll pay cash for your house. What would you say to somebody who's like, I really need to sell my house quickly? That seems like a great option for me. Why is that a good idea or a terrible idea?
So you are bringing this question up, like right towards the end of our podcast. This would be like a whole subject, but I will answer that, 'cause I think it's a very important thing.
Well, we can do the short version now and the longer version on another episode.
That's right. That's right. You're amazing on you brought up another topic earlier today too. So we appreciate you bringing up topics. And by the way, for those of you at home, if there's anything that you want to hear about in real estate, let us know. Let us know. podcast@higginshomesearch.com and we'll get your ideas on there. But anyway, the cash buyers. So this is the easiest way that I can explain it very, very quickly. Anybody that's buying a house as an investor, whether they're going to flip it or whatever the case might be, they're going to want to make a profit. That makes sense, right? Anybody that's going to be purchasing those homes as an investor wants to make a profit. So you have to ask, where are they going to make the profit? There's really two ways that an investor can make a profit, I think. One of them is they can take a home that's a little bit beat up inside, and they can put their own time, money, and energy in to improve that home. And through that improvement, they're going to be able to create a margin. And that's where their profit comes from. So the second way that investors are going to want to make money, or the second way that they can make money, is by purchasing a home from you at a discount and then turning around without really doing much to the house and relisting it at a higher price and selling it again. The margin would be their profit. The reality is that most investors are going to try to get both. they're going to try to do a cash buyer who's offering to buy your home for cash. Most of those are going to try to improve the house, and they're going to try to take advantage of the fact that you need this ultra convenience. So I think the more convenience, the more cost to you. If you're more focused on getting the highest possible price for your house and netting the most money, then you're going to have less convenience. Because in my opinion, the more people who know about your home, the more competition you create is what creates your value. So if you're going to allow one buyer to come in and purchase a home from you without any competition, they're going to take advantage of that, and they're going to make their margin through getting the home from you at a discount. So again, we could go much further into that, but that's a great question, and I appreciate you for asking that, because that's I'm sure that's on a lot of people's minds. So I think that kind of seals it up, doesn't it?
Yeah, top seven questions.
Any other great questions, Nate? We good?
I don't have any today.
All right, man. That was a fun show. We went 50 minutes. We had a good show. Nice work, bud. All right, we'll see you on the next one. Take care.